Hey guys, welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny, the only NFL podcast where one of the hosts' hand size is less than 3 inches. I guess paw size is a better way to put that. We've got another two-part pod today. It's a special MIT Sloan edition of the Mina Kimes Show. Is there this weekend? I got to chat with some interesting folks. So later in the show, in the second part, we are bringing on Warren Sharp. If you aren't familiar with Warren Sharp, get on our level. He does great stuff with predictive analytics, puts out these tremendously useful guides, one of the top NFL Twitter followers. I moderated a panel last weekend on NFL analytics, and there was so much interesting stuff and so many things we didn't get to talk about that I wanted to bring him on the pod to discuss his thoughts on analytically driven play calling, some changes coming down the pike. And also we talked a little bit about Nick Foles to the Jaguars and Josh Rosen. And speaking of Josh Rosen, while I was at the conference, I was also somehow able to trick another guest into coming on to the podcast. It wasn't Josh Rosen. It wasn't Kyler Murray. It was Larry Fitzgerald, longtime Cardinals wide receiver, first current NFL player to appear on the Mina Kimes Show. I imagine that'll be on his Hall of Fame bus, or he'll probably mention me in his speech. So before we get to Warren, here is that interview with Larry Fitzgerald. Really excited to have Larry today. This is, well, I should welcome you to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. As you, Lenny's not here.
I can tell.
Did you know Lenny was a dog? Did somebody warn you?
No, nobody told me that.
Are you a dog guy?
I do. I love all animals, especially dogs. I don't have one though.
You don't love all animals.
I do.
Really?
Yeah, I'm an animal guy. Yeah.
Like snakes.
When I was a kid, he had a dog, had a fish, and a gerbil. So I mean, we were an animal family. I was.
Which one was your favorite?
The gerbil. I used to.
Really?
Yeah, he was fun. Yeah.
Why?
Because you use the toilet paper and you get the end of the toilet paper and you put it in there and he'll eat it all in one day. You know, he just like to snack on it. So we used to always time him, see how fast he could do it and run on his will. And yeah, it was fun. Yeah.
You would do like a little gerbil combine.
Yeah. I mean, growing up in Minnesota when it was days like this, which was always like days like this and you couldn't go outside, you had to amuse yourself somehow.
Yeah. So you would just feed toilet paper the gerbils.
Yeah. That was a good day. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I like that. Okay, well, I'm glad that you're a dog guy, because this is a podcast co-hosted by a dog.
Okay.
Usually he asks questions, the whole thing. We've been talking about that. But I'm just going to jump right into it. So you are turning 36 this year.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. That's why I like you, because you're one of the few NFL players who's still older than me. And it gets smaller and smaller.
Yeah, I agree.
Every year. Yeah, is it weird being in an industry where everyone treats you like you're like a crypt keeper when you're 36, even though in any other industry that would be really like young?
Yeah, it is interesting, but those guys, the young guys, keep me young too. A lot has changed, over the years. I mean, the communication has definitely changed. You know, you walk in a locker room, back when I first got in, it was loud and guys talking and communicating. Now everybody's on the Snapchat and Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, doing their thing, and nobody's really talking. So I mean, that's a shift in the dynamic of the locker room.
Huh? Does that bother you?
No, I mean that's just that's everywhere. I mean, you walk out in the street, people, they don't speak. They're on their phones, doing their thing, living their lives. That's just the way it is now.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because actually yesterday Adam Silver was talking about that with the NBA and how guys, they don't get on the bus and talk. They get on the bus and they put on their AirPods, fancy, and I guess he was kind of saying that might affect the team dynamic. And do you feel like that in some ways can be a negative?
Well, in a team setting, in sports or even in the corporate world, it's very important to have that good communication, especially with your peers, people you're working very closely with. And I always, put your phone down, man. What's going on with life? How's your family? Mom, dad, kids good? I like to have that dialogue with my partners. And I think it's important to build that trust and the camaraderie that you need to be a successful team. And, it's the future's here. The technology's gonna be here, and it's gonna keep evolving. But I think the interpersonal skills is something that we need to continue to develop.
To work on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you ever just like annoyed by them? Because it's like a bunch of 21-year-olds. I can't imagine being in a workplace where I was surrounded by 21-year-olds, and they're like, are they ever using slang and talking about like Lil Pump, Lil Xan, and you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. I can't relate to you anymore.
No, I can relate, you know, because I hear, I listen to the same music they listen to. You know, I'm forced to in the locker room, so I kind of pick it up. But you know, I don't have a problem with it. You know, my oldest is 11 years old, and so I mean, I see it. It's constantly evolving and changing. And if you don't change and learn to evolve, you're gonna get behind.
You're like, I love Lil Pump.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I can tolerate him. Yeah.
What do you do now at 35 that you didn't have to do when you were 25 even to take care of your body?
Well, I kind of just stay with the same script that I've stayed with. You know, it's worked thus far, and I continue to utilize it. I think the biggest thing now is the mental aspect, staying sharp with that, because the game of football hasn't changed at all, like the routes and, you know, just called different things, but it hasn't changed. And doing it for 15 years, you know, I pretty much know what I'm doing in terms of that, but not allowing yourself to kind of divorce yourself from continuing to learn and being active and, you know, always finding new ways to improve yourself. So I think from a mental standpoint, the older you get, it becomes more difficult to stay mentally engaged all the time.
Right, because you're like, I already know all this shit. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to get really again? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you have to motivate yourself.
Yep. You always have to be able to go back to the details, because every single year you start off with, I'm talking about the basics. I mean, you get back to footwork 101, running slants. You know, I've run a million of them, you know, and so early in the off season, I can be a little lethargic at times. So I have to be able to stay on myself and, you know, really be able to commit to starting all over again and really putting emphasis on the small things.
I think it was about, gosh, at this point, 6 or 7 years ago that you actually changed positions in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, and what, 2012, am I right?
Yeah, 13.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you wanted to do?
No, it wasn't something I really wanted to do. I was highly successful where I was, and I think the biggest thing that was tough for me is that it wasn't something that was really communicated with me. It was just like, hey, Fitz, this is what you're going to do. You're moving to this. It wasn't open dialogue. And so I struggled with that. But at the end of the day, it really made me a much better player, and it actually made me a better man, too.
Okay.
I think that whenever in life you're pushed out of your comfort zone, you learn a lot about yourself, you know. And ever since I was 6 years old, I was the best at what I did. You know, there's many guys that tried to take my job, but they just were never good enough. And for the first time, I had a coach that didn't think I can do something. And I know you guys maybe face similar situations in your work life. There's a young guy who's great credentials, it's a wonderful academic, you know, standards, and they want to get him in and try him at a different position because he's younger, not because he's earned it, but he's younger. And, you know, I just had to fight. And, you know, for the first time, you know, my back was against the wall, and I was able to produce. And it actually made me a much better player, too.
And would you say perhaps it's lengthened your career in some inside?
Yeah, without question. When you're looking at the glass like it's half empty, sometimes you lose perspective, and I had to change my thought process.
Interesting. So Bruce Arians, you're speaking of back in the league. Everybody has a Bruce Arians story. I was wondering, what's something you can tell us about Bruce that people don't know?
Well, coach, you know, from outside looking in, he's a tough ass. I mean, he can be very boisterous in terms of his delivery of his messages, and sometimes he doesn't use the greatest vernacular. And so you have to be able to, you know, block out the words and try to grasp the message. But behind all of that, underneath that, you have a really loving, caring human being that would do anything for you. And I remember my first year there, University of Pittsburgh, my alma mater, where I went to college, was going to graduate, were going to retire my number. And the day that they were going to retire my number, we had practice on that day. And you know, this is not something I've ever done or ever would do, but, you know, it was a special occasion. I went to coach and I said, coach, look, I really would like to participate in this ceremony back in Pittsburgh. is going to require me to miss practice, which I've never done, and I don't want to do. And he said, Fitz, you know what, man? It's a great honor. It doesn't happen all the time. You know what? We're gonna give the guys a day off today, and then we'll practice. So he flipped the schedule.
Wow.
for me. It was something that, you know, made me really, really appreciate him. And you know, that was something that I think kind of defined him with me, you know, because he didn't have to do that. I mean, as a new coach, we didn't even have an established relationship at that point, but he just did it. And, you know, something I always remember and never forget.
Do you like his hats?
Yeah, I do. I do like his hats. I like that he embraces his own style and look. He's creative. And, you know, that's not easy to do. You know, people clowned him at first, and then it became his thing, you know, when he won Coach of the Year again.
Something that someone, it's a flex incoming, you and I both know, Aaron Rodgers once told me about you was that what he thought was special about your game, and we're laughing before because I feel like this comes up every time you're playing, the announcers are always stressing it. Do you know what I'm about to say?
I have no
Such
idea.
Such a great blocker.
Oh.
And he was saying specifically, and I thought this was cool, he said he's the only wide receiver ever who would really take on Cam Chancellor, who's kind of the gold standard of, like, you don't want to, no one wants to do that. But he's like, I remember watching him play, Larry would take on Cam. And I was wondering with the blocking, like, is that something you actually enjoy or...
No, I wouldn't say I enjoy it, but I know it's a part of the game that that is needed, and also understand that for our running game and for other guys to be able to go out there and be willing blockers, you have to do it as a leader. And once I embraced it, we became better as a blocking team. Everybody in my room became better. They started taking more pride in it. And, you know, the running backs and the tight ends and the quarterbacks, everybody else appreciated it. And, you know, it just became, you know, part of our DNA and who we were. And, you know, so there's things that leaders have to do that they don't always like and appreciate, but it's for the betterment of the team.
Have you noticed that announcers talk about that a lot with you?
I never watch.
On the field, maybe.
Yeah. I don't ever watch the TV copies of any games.
Any games?
No.
So you don't hear what they say.
Never. You know, we have a you know, the copies of the tape we watch
it's
different. Yeah, the coach's tape.
So you never watch like Sunday Night Football? You don't know about the Collinsworth slide?
No.
Wow.
No, I only really watch the football that I'm actually having to participate in.
Yeah, that's a real flex. Are you a TV guy? Do you watch a lot of TV?
Not really.
Really? Nothing? You're not?
No, if I watch TV, it's usually like some Netflix stuff, you know, series, or it's golf. That's what I really watch.
You're
a lot
really
of. Yeah, I like watching golf.
What's your Netflix show?
Right now, I'm catching up on some of the last episodes of Scandal.
You're behind.
I'm way behind, but I'm addicted. I watched like five in a row, you know, and Designated Survivor was one I just got finished with. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
The Bodyguard was outstanding.
Oh, I love Bodyguard.
Yeah, so, I mean, I kind of just get into it and go. Yeah.
I watched Bodyguard in like one day.
Yeah.
You would be an excellent Designated Survivor. Tell me about the moment. It's just a thought. Really, though, like, wouldn't you want him, like, higher than most people in this country? As, like, maybe I would put him top 20 at least in line. Tell me about the moment when you decided to return next season.
Well, we had a really bad season last year, and
correct.
You know, I just didn't want to go out on that level. You know, I mean, you got to live the rest of your life knowing you went out on that level. I mean, we're picking number one this year, so that should just show you how bad it was.
Yeah.
It's 31 other teams that did better than you out of 32, and that's never a good position to be in. And I really didn't want to go out like that.
So you were like, this can't be it for me.
No, I still enjoy it. I can still play. I mean, I'm not the player that I was 10 years ago, but I can still go out there and contribute. I can make plays. I can be somebody who can situationally really, you know, help the teams and make explosive plays for my group.
You've been on such like a roller coaster in Arizona. And by the way, with this 16th season, that's going to be the longest any wide receiver has played on one team ever. With this year, you had previously tied the prior year, which is so rare. And it's interesting to think like how it shook out that way. And there's always been rumors of you over the years to go to a championship team and the Patriots. What's the closest you ever came to leaving?
Well, there's a few times I know I've been on a trading block, but things didn't get finalized. But I mean, for a guy to stay in the same place, it has to be something that's mutual. You have to, the ownership has to want you. You have to want to stay. There's many times when I was in contract disputes that, you know, things could have been said and feelings could have been hurt, and things would have been different. But, you know, I've always had a desire to stay in Arizona. I really enjoy living there. I enjoy being a part of something, you know, that's bigger than the game. You know, I'm very involved in the community there. I find it very important to serve your community. They do so much for me and my family, and I find it, you know, gratifying to be able to stay in one place. You know, just the younger generation is a little different. I mean, they don't mind moving and jumping and playing with their friends. I've always wanted to beat my friends as opposed to joining up with them. You know, it's just I take more pride in that.
And obviously there's been high highs in Arizona two periods in particular, but as you mentioned, last year was rough. What's the hardest part of being on a team that's losing like that people don't know about?
Well, just keeping everybody focused and objective. I mean, I think the narrative changes throughout the course of the year. Obviously, you go in, you want to win, you want to win the division, and you want to get to the playoffs. And then it kind of gets to a point where you kind of deal with reality. You know, you're not going to be a playoff team, but you still have to improve and get better and start building on the seasons to come. You know, when you have a rookie quarterback like we do in Josh Rosen and rookie receivers around me and a lot of just young guys in general, they need that playing experience. There's no substitute for playing, and I'm always trying to just teach those guys and try to help them, you know, speed up the learning curve. So, I mean, the narrative changed throughout the year, but I think it was a productive season and the young guys got better.
You've had like 18 quarterbacks, I think, something like
that. I've had a few.
Can you name them all?
If you give me some time, probably not right now.
I was looking at the list and I was like, oh, wow, okay.
It's a lot.
With Rosen, you know, I've been saying, people listen to podcasts now, like, I can't judge him. I have no idea what to, you know, I have nothing to gain. But there is a concern sometimes with rookies when they are in a difficult situation that it can hinder their development or be difficult for them. Is that something you were concerned about looking back in his first year?
No, Josh is unique in terms of his mentality. He's extremely confident, and not in a bad way, but he's able to forget very quickly a bad play, a bad decision. Now he's really good at being able to put things behind him. He's a great teammate, really insightful, just great to be around. And he's somebody who's really trying to learn always. He's inquisitive about life, and people like that usually find a way to be successful because they just put the effort in. And he's got some talented guys around him that are going to help continue to make plays for him, and I think he's going to be just fine. Coach Cliff Kingsbury is our new head coach. He's an offensive guru. Been everywhere he's gone. His offense is produced at a high level, and I don't think anything's going to be different when he comes in Arizona.
With Josh, what's something you think we'll see in terms of taking a next step next year? Are we going to see him next year?
Yeah, I think it was difficult to really evaluate him because, you know, out of the 10 offensive linemen we started the season with, only 9 of them actually finished in the season. So if you're a quarterback and you can't stay on your feet, it's very difficult to make a throw, let alone to be able to evaluate you. You know, we got to get guys healthy and be able to protect them, and we got to make some plays around them. You know, it's, you know, Tom Brady won the Super Bowl this year, but I saw a lot of guys making plays, you know, in that game. A lot of offensive linemen doing their thing and keeping them safe, and, you know, it's a team game.
And he was untouched, right?
A lot of the times. Yeah, a lot of the times.
With Cliff, by the way, have you got time to kind of think through his offense and potentially your role in that offense?
No, we didn't talk anything about roles. I think roles are kind of defined as he sees what we're all capable of doing. And I think it's important that a coach just be honest with you as well and not tell you this is what we want to see. Let me see what you can do and let me see where you can fit in our system. I like that. I think all our guys respect the way he's come in and, you know, really just say, look, there's some things we're going to change. It's going to be simple. We're going to play fast and we're going to make explosive plays. We're going to do the little things to make it successful, but it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take every single body working every single day to change that.
He's closer in age to you than most of the players.
Yeah, so we can relate well, probably.
I was going to say, you guys can chill.
Yeah.
What was your first impression of him besides handsome?
That wasn't my first impression at all.
Is he the most handsome coach you've ever had?
No, I really don't define the men like that. You know, I just
like Bruce Arians.
I don't really define them like that. But I mean, I like him. He's real chill. You know, I like that he's played the game.
Yeah.
You know, he's played it at a high level, played in the National Football League, was a great collegiate player, and he's young, so he can relate to the players. It's not like that old school mentality where it's going to be this way. I think he has a great grasp of what players need in this modern age of football players.
Speaking of the modern age, what do you make of the passing explosion? Are you like, really could have used this, guys, in like 2004 when I was younger? Your stats
could use
it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with my stats. It's all about being able to get wins. And, you know, to be able to throw that ball around like that, you got to be able to stop some people every once in a while also. And I think you saw that in the Super Bowl when the biggest game of the season was a defensive slugfest. I mean, there's two defenses that play at a high level, and you know, obviously the Patriots made a few more plays down the stretch to be able to get a win, but you know, we might talk about this is going to be a high scoring game, and it really wasn't. I think it just emphasized how important defense really is.
Yeah, it really came down to this like one drive, yep. Really, right? So it's a 1-year deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talked about why you did it in the first place, which is you didn't want to go out like that last year. What do you hope to accomplish this year on that 1 year?
Well, I think my role is changed, and I think it's important for me to continue to help the Christian Kirks of the world and the Josh Rosen of the world, the guys that are going to be here for the next 10 years playing, and, you know, just give them all the knowledge I can to help speed up their learning curve. You know, I wasn't fortunate enough to have anybody as in a veteran leadership role when I got in the league, and I know I struggled my first and second year just learning how to be a pro, doing the things that great pros do to have sustained long-lasting careers, and anything I can do to impart that knowledge to them at an early age, I think will be beneficial to not only them but to our franchise for the long term.
Do you think this will be it this year?
I don't know. I don't ever put a timeline on. I mean, I know at the end of the year, I feel like, no, this is not it.
Yeah.
There's been times before where I feel like I probably should be done. And then, you know, 2-3 weeks after that, when my body starts feeling better, you know, you change your mind. But, you know, I think it's important that you just stay in the moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of guys who talk about retirement, but they don't know what they're going to do. You don't strike me as someone who doesn't know what he's going to do, because you already have companies, you've got a travel company, everyone knows you've got like myriad interests. So do you have it all plotted out afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, I have a pretty good plan of what I want to do, but you know, you have to execute it. I think it's nerve-wracking, you know, starting something completely new, but I've done internships from every single company you can think of over the years. I've gone back to school. I've done seminars. I've done everything I possibly could to put myself in position to be successful post-career, but like, you have to go out there and do it still at the end of the day.
Would it be anything football-related, like coaching?
No.
And you're like, well, I'm done.
No.
What about media?
No.
Okay.
No.
You're like, I'd never do that.
No. I don't think so.
One last thing I wanted to ask you, and I'll let you go. So we're both from Arizona. I'm sure some of you guys know this about Larry's relationship with Senator John McCain, and I delivered a really beautiful speech at his funeral. You should really go read it if you have a chance. It's probably online or something you can watch, right?
I think so.
Yeah, and I guess I was just wondering how you became friends with him.
So I met him in 2007 or 2008, and we were just at a small get together. It was a charity event, and I saw him over there, and everybody was talking to him, and I just waited my turn. I went over and shook his hand. I had known his story, and obviously, you know, respected him a great deal for what he did and the sacrifices he made for our country. And I talked to him briefly, and you know, we just chatted a little bit, and then I went on about my way. And then I got a note from somebody in his team, and he said, "Hey, I'm gonna be in the Valley. We're gonna be ending sessions in the Senate, and I would like to sit down and have lunch." And so, met and we had lunch, and you know, we just really just struck up a really nice relationship. We stayed in touch. I would go visit him in Sedona. I would go visit him in D.C., sitting on some of the, you know, hearings, and go hang out with him in Capitol Hill. And it just really started to develop into, you know, a genuine relationship. And You know, after getting to know him and talking in great detail about some of the experiences he had in Vietnam, I went to Vietnam and I got a chance to get a private tour of, you know, the Hilton Hanoi, where the prison he was incarcerated in for, you know, 4 years, and went to the lake where his plane, you know, was shot down, and, you know, just kind of just did, walked his journey. And it was really a special relationship for me and something that, you know, I always hold near and dear to my heart.
Do you feel like his voice is missing today?
Yeah, you know, he was one of those guys who was Republican by party, but, you know, he voted on what he felt was right. And it didn't matter what side of the aisle, he tried to get everybody to work together. And I think now it's becoming more and more difficult now for things to get accomplished because everybody has their own agendas as opposed to it being most important what is best for our country and the people. And so I think that's something that we're going to miss.
No.
No.
Keep trying.
No.
All right. Well, thank you so much for seeing
you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Great to always be with an Arizona.
All right. So for the second half of today's podcast, I am delighted to inform you that we are being joined by Warren Sharp, who's kind of like your favorite football writer's favorite football writer. I think a good way to describe him. He runs sharpfootballanalysis.com, sharpfootballstats.com, where you can find just great data and, you know, analytics, predictive analytics. He puts out these tremendous reports that just about every football analyst and football geek I know reads, and is incredible on Twitter. One of the best follows out there. Very informative and damning threads on teams and their decision making. Warren, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Love your podcast. Definitely happy to spend a little bit of time with you on it.
Well, and so we're coming off of the Sloan Conference, and you were on my panel, which was diminished in size. It started with five, and it came down to three. So we got to hear a little bit more from you there. And after the panel, I kind of felt like, I have more questions to ask him. I want to, you know, also ask him some things that we talked about on the panel. So I thought it would be fun to have you on just to go through that. But before we get into, you know, my questions about analytics and some of your thoughts on where the league is going, I wanted to ask you about your own career, because as you explained to the crowd, you were an engineer for a long time, and this was, doing NFL research was a bit of a side hustle. Like most people who are smart and get into NFL research, it was associated with sports betting. But what prompted you now to make the jump into focusing on football full time?
I think it was just the timing of everything that was going on in the marketplace and sort of with my own career. Once there were teams that were interested in the spring of bringing me on as a consultant, I knew that was obviously going to be another workload for me. It was also obviously a revenue stream, but it meant a lot more work. And it was work, fortunately for me, that's early in the week. So normally with the sports betting work that I do and the research into football that I do, it's slower on, you know, Monday, and then it starts ramping up on Tuesday, and then, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, et cetera. It gets more and more. I have to write an article to file for ESPN on Thursday. So it just gets more and more work as the week goes on. But the work for the teams is really early. It's like starts midnight Sunday night. I'm cranking all the way through, don't sleep until a report's due on Monday morning, and then the same thing happens and a report's due on Tuesday at noon. So it kind of balanced with that, but it also left me with, hey, there's no time that I can actually do my engineering work here. Like I can't get anything done. So I kind of realized that I wasn't going to be able to continue with it. And in addition, I'm one of hundreds of thousands of people across the country who is good at analyzing schedules on construction projects that finish late and, you know, testifying at trials or supporting people who testify at trials. So nothing special with that, but I realized in this context of what I could do for football that there weren't, although I'm excited to see more people popping up with great skill sets and a lot of ability to do this, like there wasn't as many people in this field who are really good at this. And, just kind of supply and demand, teams wanted to use me. So I realized I needed to make a move. I needed to make a change in my career. And so stepping away from the engineering work and focusing full time on the football analysis side of things.
Okay, wait. So were you an expert witness? Was that a fancy way of saying that? Because as somebody who loves legal shows, like The Good Wife, for those, like there'll be a trial and they'll say, well, was it possible for the killer to cross that bridge? I guess your trials probably weren't murders, but
No.
Is that what you did?
We most of the time, like I've been deposed, but most of the time what I'm doing is supporting the people who are actually testifying. So there'd be a number of different cases where I'm attending depositions. I'm supporting the trials. I'm working with attorneys. I'm at the courthouses for as long as the trial is going on, working after, working before, prepping expert witnesses that are testifying, whether it's somebody from my firm or elsewhere, to try to help make sure that we get everybody onto the same page. So that was a portion of it. Most of the cases, to be honest, don't end up in trial. They get settled prior to that. So it's only certain cases that actually get to that point. But that type of work is obviously interesting, and it's fun. And every single project, every construction project we do is different. But it's just not, it wasn't my passion. It wasn't nearly as entertaining, exciting as football.
You made it sound way less sexy than being in a murder case. So, yeah, but actually, you mentioned your passion is football. And before you came on, you and I were talking about how you grew up in Wisconsin. I asked you if you were a Packers fan growing up. And you said something I think is interesting, because you said you weren't really a fan of a team, which is actually pretty unusual in football. I think it's more common in basketball these days, but most people grow up rooting for a team. Like, how did you get into football without having a particular team?
My dad, was big into sports, right? He actually played sports at college. So he was really into, obviously, sports, and I did a lot of different things. I did primarily soccer, basketball growing up, but really loved watching football. I would always sit there and watch football with him. And one of the things that frustrated me with his, what he did is he root for teams like, he was a big Packers fan because his business used to be there. Mm-hmm. He also rooted for the Steelers, a little bit for the Redskins. And just every time, like Sunday afternoon, when whatever team he's rooting for watching on TV lost, he gets so frustrated, so upset, sometimes turn off the game beforehand, walk out of the room. It just like completely screwed up his day. I just wanted to watch the games and see what was going on, but I would never really let that kind of impact my day. So I always kept trying to watch the teams, and I just remember, like, it was virtually any sport that he was watching, he tended to root for upsets. He tended to root for, the small guy to beat the little guy. And I think that part of that played into, his upbringing and what he was doing in college, like never the most skilled, the best, but always was like trying to scrap and scrape and get there. And so I always found myself kind of rooting for, whether it's like you're rooting against Jordan, you're rooting against, the Dallas Cowboys with their unlimited salary cap, or the 49ers, you're always rooting for like the smaller guys to make inroads and beat some of the bigger teams. And so I always tended to find myself in the same position of rooting for upsets. And that kind of actually maybe like set the groundwork for where I am now, which is trying to figure out ways that teams can maximize their efficiency in order to compete better and win easier. And, just always looking for little edges that I think any team could utilize, as opposed to just, letting the bigger, best team just dominate and win every single season.
That's tremendous. And it's completely the opposite of my own experience into being assimilated by my father into unrepentant homerism, which has brought me nothing but pain. So good for you for not going down that route. I mean, I was at his knee as a young child, watching some pretty horrible Seahawks years. And unlike you, I did not shake that unfortunate allegiance for 2 decades. And maybe that's a good segue into something I wanted to ask you about. So I mentioned earlier, you're an amazing follow on Twitter, and really, you put together these threads where you're kind of breaking down mistakes and or advice for teams and games. And if you listen to the podcast, you might have heard Warren, I don't know how many minutes it was, but I went on a bit of a rant about Brian Schottenheimer after the wildcard game. And I feel that we are like-minded of it. So I'm going to the tweet you wrote, and it was a thread about that game. You wrote, "One of the worst called games with a good quarterback I can remember." So tell me about what you saw in that game, what you saw from Seattle, and why you were so dispirited by the display of play calling.
Well, it was just really mind-boggling to me. It's one thing if you have a poor quarterback and you think, well, this is what we've done all year. We've run the ball, so we're going to have to run it. And just hope that this team with a really good run defense won't be able to stop it. But, you know, the opposite is true in Seattle. They actually have Russell Wilson, and he actually averaged 8.6 yards per attempt and recorded a 106 passer rating in that game.
Pretty good.
I mean, pretty good. He was able to throw the ball, move the ball. He's actually a really good quarterback. And the fact that I understand they have this philosophy and mindset, which is kind of Pete Carroll on down, that we want to run the ball, and obviously Brian Schottenheimer acquiesced to that. He came back from Georgia, didn't have a lot of success at Georgia, but hey, you know, Brian, come on in here. We're going to let you call plays, but remember, we want to establish our foundation of a run-first team. Okay, that's great with me, Coach. I love that philosophy. And so these two kind of just were linked at the hip with this idea that this is what they were going to do, but it really just cuts into the fiber of what I believe and feel, and that is that every single week you must change your game plan to try to maximize your efficiency and your ability to win in that particular game. And that is one thing that they definitely did not do at all in this game. They continued to run the ball. They were having no success running the football in the first half. And so this is where, like, I personally would have come into the game with a totally different game plan and a totally different philosophy. But let's pretend that you want to just do what you normally do, and this is what you're going to do. At halftime, you have to think that we need to adjust here. They're trailing every offensive play of the second half. The run game is accomplishing nothing. And they continued to run the ball on first down. The very first four drives of the second half, every single first down play call was a run. They had six running back runs to you know, I think of their first like seven first downs in the second half. These plays were averaging 3.9 yards per carry, a 14% success rate. I just could not fathom how a team that is in this situation, it is not as if it's like a preseason game, game four of the regular season. It's a playoff game. It's win or go home. And yet they did not adapt beforehand. They did not adapt at halftime. They were oblivious to what was going on the field. And the play calling lost this game. This was a totally winnable game that was blown because of the strategy from the coaching staff to try to do something that was going to be inefficient, that was inefficient, and but we're going to continue to do it anyways. And you have Russell Wilson at quarterback. It is just mind-boggling.
Well, that was triggering. Thanks for reviving all of those memories. You know, my theory about kind of like how they got to that point is that the first two games of the Seattle season, they did actually pass a lot, but the line couldn't pass block for shit, right? So I feel like after that, those first two games, one with Chicago, they in Denver, they Carroll and Schottenheimer got together and they said, listen, our line can't pass protect. We got to run more. That's going to be our identity. And it worked, right? But as you mentioned, things change. Different teams are different. Different games are different. And the team evolved too, because I often see people say, well, the reason the Seahawks ran the ball so much is that they struggled in pass pro, which is true to an extent. But when you look at the statistics, You just laid out how excellent Russell Wilson was as a passer, okay? And that doesn't mean necessarily that the pass protection was perfect, but it certainly indicates that passing was working. Oh my God, I'm getting worked up again. Okay, whatever. I agree with you. This is just immensely frustrating, and obviously everyone's coming back next year, so we'll see how that shakes out. Actually, you know,
if Russell Wilson was slightly injured or banged up, because a lot about a football, especially in the playoffs, is how healthy is your roster? What can you do with this roster? What can you craft? Do you have wide receivers that are injured and you got nobody to throw the football to? You know, like Aaron Rodgers had a couple of years ago when he was going into Atlanta and just like everybody was banged up. So, okay, we got to do something here. Or is your quarterback injured? And, you know, but Russell Wilson was healthy and his receivers were there. Like it really didn't make a lot of sense whatsoever.
You talked about the importance of making adjustments for the game, especially in the playoffs, right, where it's when you go home. And I feel like that there was no game that better exemplified the contrast in teams doing that than the Super Bowl. So I'm going to read a tweet that I wrote, which is a very solipsistic exercise, but it's about you. And it was written on January 30th, 2019, so before the Super Bowl. Mina Kimes wrote, reading Sharp Football's excellent Super Bowl preview, and this jumped out. The Pats' pass defense ranks third in success rate versus 11 personnel and 26! Versus 12. Could see the Rams deviating from their formula. Warren, did they deviate from their formula?
Oh my God, this is You know, we tempered all of this discussion on the panel because I'm going to be a professional when I'm up there. But certainly,
so, by the for those who don't know, we had the Rams an executive on the panel. Sorry.
Right. Exactly. So I didn't want to get into, and you appropriately did not dive into these subject matters, but I, through doing a lot of research, the answer to your question is no. They did not deviate until it was nearly too late. I mean, they still could have won the game. That game was close. They could have won this game. And had they, but the point being that they didn't deviate from their usage of 11 personnel until very late in the game, where they began to sprinkle it in, and it was actually extremely successful. But had they gone to it earlier, they probably would have had much more success. And you're absolutely right. There's two things that you want to be looking at when you're talking about crafting a game plan. What is the opponent's weakness? And is it in our purvey of options to be able to, of things that we could possibly do to be able to attack that weakness? Can we attack this at all? We're going to have to change everything, our entire philosophy to do that. That maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But the Patriots were, like you said, one of the best teams in the NFL at defending 11 personnel, but significantly worse defending 12 personnel. And the Rams easily could have attacked from 12 personnel because they actually were successful throwing the ball out of 12 personnel, particularly once they lost Cup to injury. Their 11 personnel package was no longer anywhere close to being as efficient or effective as their 12 personnel was. So why not try to utilize it a little bit? Start at the beginning of the game, try it a few plays, see if it works, and then maybe move on. They had 36 pass dropbacks from 11 personnel over the entire game, only 6 from 12 personnel. The 12 personnel delivered 8.8 yards per attempt and a 60% success rate. And I know your listeners are well-educated, so they probably don't need to know that the difference between 11 and 12 is just that you take an extra receiver off the field in 11 and substitute on a tight end. So you've got two tight ends. That's what the 2 in 12 means. And in 11 personnel, 5.6 yards per attempt, that's basically 3.2 yards per attempt worse, and a 29% success rate. That's nearly half of the success rate. The 60% success rate was from 12 personnel. And the key to remember from that sequence, 11 versus 12, the best chance that they had to score a touchdown in the entire game is when they had a first and 10 at the Patriots 29-yard line. Jared Goff drops back, misses a wide-open Brandon Cooks, who was streaking in the middle of the end zone. He ends up throwing it way late. McCourty's able to come over, knock his hand. It's an incompletion. It would have been a touchdown on that first and 10 pass. That was the very first time that the Rams passed the ball out of 12 personnel and actually used both tight ends to block and chip. That's why Goff had so much time that you know, it hurt them. It hurt them he had too much time. He should have thrown it earlier, but he had such a big pocket and nobody around him. He could have thrown it earlier. That was 3 minutes and 42 seconds left in the third quarter. That was the first time they even attempted something like that. So very frustrating.
We talked a lot about that play after the Super Bowl because, you know, when I was watching it, I was immensely frustrated. You know, dude was wide open. And my colleague Dan Orlovsky pointed out, I think that the Patriots at the last minute, they disguised their coverage and they basically tricked Goff, right, when he turned around because it was play action. But one thing that struck me about that game in particular was just that the Patriots defense consistently had time to do that. Were you surprised that the Rams didn't run more tempo in this game, given what the Patriots defense was doing, and the way that they were deceiving Goff using, you know, time to their advantage?
Extremely. I could not understand it. I thought that for sure at halftime they were going to come back and go a lot more up tempo in the second half. They played in the NFC Championship game. And down in New Orleans, that was impossible for them to really go tempo. It was a hostile crowd. There was crowd noise. It was just very difficult for them to, like, maintain a lot of success using tempo in that environment. But in the Super Bowl, I surely thought, okay, they're going to get back to a lot of tempo in this game. Why would it be a downgrade? But they ran 18 plays where they snapped the ball inside of 5 seconds left on the play clock. Those plays gained 1.4 yards per play and Goff threw an interception. They ran 5 plays where they snapped the ball with 1 second left in the play clock. Those 5 plays gained 0.2 yards per play. It was just so evident that running the play clock down, I know that they thought they got the strategy where if they didn't snap it early, then the Patriots wouldn't be able to change late on them. So they could just run it down, and then the Patriots would be stuck in the defense that they were in. But clearly the Patriots were doing what they wanted to do after the fact. They had plenty mm-hmm. after the snap. They had plenty of time to disguise it. So actually snapping the ball earlier would have really been able to make things more difficult on the Patriots' ability to communicate ahead of that snap. To really set up what they were going to shift into after the snap.
That defense is so freaking well coached. I mean, that was just my takeaway from that game when I rewatched it. Like, holy shit. I mean, it's, which is, you know, always the X factor. When we talk about the Patriots, and you and I can say, well, like, teams need to be flexible. Like, you know, that they ran obviously significant. We went all over this all after the Super Bowl, how many changes they made in terms of adjusting to this game. But that requires a level of execution, coaching, everything that, is why I thought Dante Hightower should have been the MVP. But, you know, that's in a game by game basis, but they're also analytically driven decisions that are working broadly across the league, passing more on early downs, passing to running backs, increased usage of play action. So I wanted to ask you, is there anything you think we're going to continue to see good teams do next season? Perhaps trends that you might see, I don't know, come into vogue as more teams lean on smart decisions?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that you mentioned are things that we will see. Definitely, we saw a big change. We talked about this on our panel of teams passing the ball more on first down. It was the first time in NFL history that teams passed the ball at least 51% of their first and 10 play calls in the first half. The reason why I isolate what they're doing just in the first half, so you eliminate any of the types of situations, score, time, et cetera, that happen in the second half. And you're just looking at what their general strategies are heading into the game, what their philosophies are. A lot of pass. The past few years, we were down in like the 49% range, 48% some years. And those passes are having a really high floor, meaning they have a high completion rate. Like it was 20 years ago, the completion rate was like 58%. Now we're up to 67.6%, which is a massive improvement in that floor. Like, what's the worst expectation that's going to happen here? We're having a lot more of those passes being complete than incomplete. We're having higher yards per attempt. So all these things favor first and 10 passing, which I think is going to increase and still needs to increase. I think our ability to call runs in the proper situation, which generally speaking is not on first and 10, will be beneficial around the league. But one of the things that I noticed is last season, we saw more teams pass the football. We saw the rate of passes increase, but teams are getting less creative when they're doing that. What they're doing is like the rate of passing has been 69% the last 2017 and 2016, 69% of all passes came from 11 personnel. Okay, that's the three wide receivers. And what we saw last season was, although there are more passes being thrown, we're actually trotting out 11 personnel at a higher rate. Up to 73% of all passes last year were thrown out of 11 personnel. And it was, you know, that's a pretty big jump from year over year, seeing that 4% increase of pass from 11 personnel. But passes from 12 personnel, which we talked about before, having those two tight ends out there and two wide receivers with them, those passes were 6% more successful than 11 personnel. They averaged one more yard per attempt, which doesn't sound like much, but again, over the averages, it is. And that's despite a similar air yards per attempt. So they're not aiming downfield. The target depth isn't that much bigger, but these passes have much higher upside from a yards per attempt perspective. They have a higher touchdown rate, a lower interception rate, and importantly, a lower sack rate. So we're talking about what the floor is. The floor is higher out of 12 than it is out of 11 personnel. And I think that we've got a lot of great tight ends in this year's draft class.
Yeah.
Teams need to be throwing the football more to tight ends. You need to get great tight ends on the field, because look at all the possibilities that exist when you have a great 12 personnel package. When you have tight ends that could stay in there and chip or block. And look, the Rams don't have great blocking tight ends, but you stick a couple tight ends who are obviously bigger than a running back on the end of your line of scrimmage, you're going to have better success and more time in the pocket for your quarterback if both those guys stay in there to block than if they weren't there. So having the ability, even if they're not like both good blocking tight ends, to get out on the field together and determine based on what play you want to call, are both these guys going to go out on the pass route, or is one going to stay back to help protect? Are both going to stay back protect for mass protection? You still have the ability to throw to a running back out of the backfield which is a very good efficiency boost on early downs. You still have two wide receivers out there, and these tight ends create so many mismatches. The routes, types of routes that they run, their size, their speed, compared to a lot of the linebackers or safeties, you would have to come down and cover them. They just have matchup edges. So sticking two of them out there on the field, I think, is a massive boost. So what I believe needs to happen this year, although I don't know that it will, is I believe that we need to have more 12 personnel. We need to throw the ball more to our tight ends on the field. These tight end passes, if you look at just pure success rate, if you're somebody who loves success rate from a pure success rate, those passes are more efficient than passes to wide receivers in virtually most every single situation. If you, like, any down, any distance, if you throw the ball to the tight end, you're going to have a higher success rate than if you threw the ball to a wide receiver. So more tight ends, pass more tight ends out on the field, more passes to tight ends. I think that's going to be an ability. Don't run the ball more. Don't necessarily run the ball. You know, people say, oh, 12 personnel, that's a run personnel. Well, it can be, but the good thing about it is if you're running out of 12, then you still have the ability to spread the defense, because you still could put the tight ends, you could split them out and still spread the defense and then run against that, which is the most efficient way to run the football, especially if you're doing it so on early downs, is from a spread formation, not from a condensed formation. But if the defense is going to adjust based on personnel and stick an extra linebacker out there and take a guy away from the secondary, then you could just pass the ball on them. So I'm just a huge fan of 12 personnel and hope that more teams utilize it.
Hey, what you're describing sort of in terms of changes in personnel usage and who's effective, who's not, is why I always like to look at the draft and free agency in terms of cycles and how the types of players that are valued and how they're valued can be sort of predictive of future trends, right? Like, for years, maybe even 2013 through 2016, we saw middle linebackers being devalued, the linebacker position in general. And then you kind of saw offenses responding to that. Now, you know, over the last few years, you've seen more teams spending and drafting slot corners, and it'll be interesting to see if you know, with this new class of tight ends, and if teams start using tight ends more, if we'll see another swing in the pendulum in terms of which defensive positions are valued, which teams are equipped with the personnel to even counter what you're describing, Warren, because a lot of teams have been focused so long on defending 11, right? And drafting and signing the right guys to combat three wide receivers and a little speedster inside that I'm not sure. I think a lot of teams around the league aren't necessarily equipped to, I guess, go against what you're describing. And it'll be interesting to see if that affects the draft at all.
I agree. I think that, like you said, teams have been using 11 so many years now and passing more often out of it that defenses have been built over the last few years to stop 11, you know, because that's the primary passing formation that that offenses use. So they've been built defensively. We need to stop the pass. We need to be able to defend 11 personnel. But the best thing about, you know, the 12 personnel is just how dynamic it can be, because you can stick two, you know, receiving tight ends out there and have just as much firepower from the receiving position as you would if you were passing ball out of 11 personnel with a receiving tight end on the field. So you could still be just as creative, but now you're talking about different types of receivers making those catches and receptions, different body types, who are you going to defend them with, and just sticking multiple guys up there. Okay, you know, some defense, this is our defender who's going to be covering the tight end. But now you got two tight ends, and both of them can catch the ball. And by the way, if you stick a guy out there who's small, who's going to be great at defending this tight end if he catches the ball, then the tight end can just stay in the run block and just overpower that player. So, I think it's definitely a chess match, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays into what teams decide to do this season in free agency and in the draft.
Well, last question I want to talk to you about, sort of speaking of the draft and free agency. So it seems like a foregone conclusion at this point that the Jaguars are going to sign Nick Foles, even though they don't appear to have any competition for him. So we'll see what my take on that from the beginning has been, let's see what they pay him. Because we always get asked about this stuff on the shows, and I'm like, it depends on, you know, are we topping Case Keem's contract? Because, you know, significantly I hate it. But I wanted to present an idea to you, which somebody, Mike Tenier, I think, suggested this on Twitter, and I'm sort of torn on it, and obviously it depends on how you view these two guys, but he suggested that the Jaguars would be better off trading for Josh Rosen, because then you get the you know, he's cheap, you get 3 more years of cost control. Well, I guess 4 because he's a first round pick versus paying whatever they're going to pay $20 million a year or something for Nick Foles. Now, obviously, Josh Rosen had a disaster first season, and there's a debate over how much of that you can attribute to the Cardinals having the worst offense in the NFL, terrible offensive line, coordinator, etc. Which do you think is preferable? If you were Jacksonville, would you rather trade for Rosen or sign Foles?
That's a great question. I think that there are so many things. I mean, it bears mentioning what Josh Rosen was up against. One of the most injured and least experienced offensive lines in the league. If you look at what they're graded out as, like I compared all of the rookie quarterbacks last year, you know, guys who got starts like Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, and Josh Rosen. And, you know, Josh Rosen, his offensive line ranked dead last in PFF's pass blocking efficiency, ranked 26th in adjusted sack rate by Football Outsiders. Those two rankings are worse than any of these other rookie quarterbacks dealt with over the course of the season. He also played 8 defenses that ranked in the top 15 against the pass. That was the most of any of these quarterbacks in terms of difficulty of your schedule and your opponents, like playing 8 of those top 15 pass defenses more than any of the others. And he played only 6 defenses that ranked bottom 15. So that was actually the least amount of any of those other quarterbacks in terms of who they had to deal with the exception of like Lamar Jackson obviously came in a little bit later. So he had a smaller sample size, but it just a lot of things working against his favor. Then if you look at the receivers that he was able to target, you know, who he had catching the ball. I know Larry's on this podcast. He was throwing the ball to Larry. Larry's 35 years old, and nothing against older receivers, but I mean, it's difficult to maintain the same level of consistent excellence and upside on your receiving ability when you reach a certain age. And so the fact that he's still productive at 35 is a real testament to his work ethic and his nutrition and everything else that goes into it. But he's not the same receiver that he was probably 5 years ago, and the stats bear that out. He also had David Johnson, who's coming back from an ACL injury. That was his second most targeted player. And then if you look at, like, 3rd through number 7, it's like a rookie, Christian Kirk, second-year 23-year-old tight end, Ricky Seals-Jones, rookie, Trent Sherfield, second-year 24-year-old player, Chad Williams, and then a rookie running back, Chase Edmonds. Like, young players, bad offensive line, tough schedule. Oh, by the way, changing offensive coordinators after 7 weeks of the season, the team started 1-6, so they got rid of Mike McCoy. It was just a difficult first rookie season for this quarterback. Compare that to what we've seen with Nick Foles. Nick Foles, obviously, I think aggressive coaching, creative coaching, good quarterback coaching up in Philadelphia, and he was able to come in like in situations where your starting quarterback gets injured. There's not a whole lot of expectations here. Let's just try to run things down the road. He didn't play as well his first few weeks of the season before they got their starter back from injury this past season. So I think, you know, it's a very difficult situation to compare the two to one another. But the easiest thing is the contract. You know, how are you going to build this team? And if you look at the AFC South and you look at the opponents that you're dealing with there, you've got Deshaun Watson in the Houston Texans. You got Andrew Luck. You got Marcus Mariota. Like, I don't love Marcus Mariota, but the other two guys, obviously very good. They've got good structures that they're in. I think you need a longer-term plan. And Nick, to me at least, I like Nick, but he's not the type of guy who, yeah, he deserves other chances in the league, right? I don't disagree with that. But I just, you know, I don't know. I kind of would have rather seen the Josh Rosen on still 3 years plus a option year down in Jacksonville at a significantly lower cost than overpaying potentially in free agency. You tend to do that, a guy like Nick Foles, and having to, you know, work him into the situation, especially when you're dealing with a somewhat of a higher paid a running back in Leonard Fournette. So I think it's a difficult spot for them, but I would have probably chose otherwise than what they decided to do.
A bad situation, and you got to think with the cap savings from not signing Foles. If you went with a Rosen, you could, you know, go out and trade for Antonio Brown and throw a little guaranteed money
too.
His way. Oh God, that receiver group is ugly, yeah. Dude. And it reminds me of a question I brought up on our panel, which was, would you rather have a C-plus rookie quarterback, by rookie, I mean on a rookie contract, or a B-minus veteran. And most teams in the NFL will pay the veteran. I don't agree with that for all the reasons we're describing. And I think a good example is to look at the teams, and I think I mentioned this on the panel, that make it in the playoffs. It's entirely guys on rookie contracts, some of whom I would say Mitch Trubisky's probably C-plus at this point. And it's veterans who are very good, okay? And you don't see teams with mediocre, highly paid veterans making it to the playoffs. So, you know, you're with the rookie, you at least, your ceiling maybe is lower, but your floor is higher in some ways because of the opportunity cost. That's just how I feel about it. All right. We didn't have time to ask Larry the questions, but we've got time to ask a few to Warren. Let's get to it.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
So you've been throwing flames. You were throwing flames on the panel, throwing flames at Larry on the pod. You just have no fear. So I'm going to ask you, I asked Adam Lefko, who the most underrated quarterback was. I said it was Matt Ryan, by the way, last year. Who do you think is the most overrated quarterback in the NFL right now?
Wow. I usually root for the underdog, so I'm looking at the guys that are kind of underneath the radar. I guess he's not really that overrated, because I was going to say Jared Goff, only from the perspective that I believe that he is more of a product, like in the Frankenstein monster. He's more of a product of Sean McVay than he is this quarterback who has been to the playoffs in back-to-back years and has the statistics that he has. So if we're going to talk about overrated quarterbacks as just the perception of the guy, then, you know, that's not the answer. But if we're talking about, is he really the guy that's putting up these stats and that's doing what he's doing? I would say he's the most overrated in the league from that perspective.
Ooh, he brought the heat. Question number two, do you know the name of the current Bachelor?
Definitely not.
No idea. Are you completely insulated from pop culture?
Like
it's Colton. You got it. Yay.
Okay.
Former.
Well, the benefit is, I was scrolling Twitter yesterday, and people kept talking about that name. So if this wasn't the day after that, I would probably have no idea because it wouldn't be relevant on my timeline. But no, I mean, I really don't watch any types of TV shows except on like HBO. I watch The True Detective this past season. I'm going to watch Game of Thrones. So I watch those types of shows, but I don't watch any type of network TV, anything on network TV, like literally, unless it's a football game, I do not watch it, and I try to just block it out and save my brain's capacity for other things.
Did you like the season of True Detective?
I did. I thought it was good compared to season two. I was really disappointed in season two. Season one was really unique because of the characters and the script. I love kind of the script and Matthew McConaughey's, you know, the way that he spoke about things, like from a very weird transient intellectual perspective. But I thought it was really good this past season. Are you a fan of that show?
I liked it. I thought it was good too. I mean, this isn't a spoiler for those who haven't heard. It kind of ended up being more about a relationship than a mystery, right? In some ways, and marriage.
Right.
And I thought that was very interesting. Obviously the actors were phenomenal. Question three. I posted this on Twitter when the Witten news. Were you in a public place when the Witten news came across the transom?
I think this was like Wednesday or Thursday last week. I'm pretty sure I was at the combine. So I wasn't really paying attention because I had a lot of different meetings those days. So I wasn't nearly as plugged in as I am usually.
Well, my friend Bill Barnwell, we were texting about it. He was like, I'm in a restaurant. It was funny to watch everyone get the news at the same time and go, what the heck? But I posed this question on Twitter afterwards, which player do you think could come out of retirement now and still contribute to an NFL team? Mine was Calvin Johnson.
Oh, man. Interesting question. Wow.
I have another one in mind.
Who is that?
Romo. Don't you think Romo could still play? Because when he retired, he was still good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would have to be like a quarterback or a possession type receiver. I don't think it could be anybody other than that. I mean, even though the offensive linemen and defensive linemen don't move a whole lot, like the beating and the burden that their body takes, I think after a couple years out of league, some of those guys, they either do one of two things. They're either going to be really old and like kind of worn down, and then trying to lube up everything to get them back in the league is going to be tough, or they're going to be the guys that drop so much weight. You know, we've seen so many of these offensive linemen totally slim down, and they look nothing like they did back when they were playing. So those guys obviously wouldn't be able to do it. You're not going to stay in your at your playing weight at those offensive linemen for that many years, because that can be a little bit unhealthy. So I think it would have to probably be a quarterback or like a wide receiver that can become a possession type receiver. Obviously, Jason Witten, you know, he's like the most possession type receiver. He doesn't do anything except just like run to a spot and turn around and block a little bit. But Romo would be, I think, the quarterback that I would probably choose, because his brain, his intellect is still top of the game. And I think that's obviously one of the most important things. You're not going to lose your accuracy, and you're not going to lose your decision making. And so I think he'll still have both of those. If everything else is okay with him, then I think he would make a great candidate.
Poor Jason Witten, worry, you know. Romo kind of outshined him off the field, and now we're saying Romo would be a better contributor if he came back. Question four. This is tough because, you know, you've been hard on the Rams, so I we'll see how you go with this. This is something I've been asking people, and it's been interesting to see how I have my thoughts. If you were starting a team now, would you pick Kyle Shanahan or Sean McVay as your coach?
Great question. I don't think you lose in either case. I kind of like Kyle from the perspective that he is utilizing a personnel grouping, a 21 personnel, that is so unique around the league. And if that's the type of team that he wants to build, I think that brings such an advantage, especially when, like, Juszczyk can catch the ball out of the backfield. If he has the fullback that he needs, and obviously we're going to assume, like, that these guys have the quarterbacks that they need, I just think the ability for him to scheme up his offense against another defense using all the creativity that he's got. I mean, look what he did with Nick Mullins. I mean, it's just phenomenal the things that he's capable of doing. He obviously doesn't have the wins to show for it, and Sean does. So you love that about Sean. So I'm not going to downgrade Sean necessarily, but I think I would probably – and I don't know that it has that much more value of over flipping a coin, but I would lean towards Kyle Shanahan.
It's close. And this is, it's funny because it's a very un-analyticsy point coming off of our conversation. But with Sean, the reason I might lean towards him, even though I love Kyle Shanahan's offense, is just you hear so much about him being an excellent manager of people, which is an underrated aspect of being a head coach. And we talk about the Rams this time last year, everyone was asking, can all those crazy personalities work in a locker room? Well, nothing happened, right? And that's a testament to McVay. By the way, your point about Shanahan, it'll be interesting to me to see what Matt LaFleur does in Green Bay, a guy who's obviously tied to both coaches, but from what I've heard, is more likely to be influenced by Shanahan in terms of the offense he puts together there. So I'll be curious to see if they run, you know, like 21 in that Packers offense. Would be kind of interesting.
It would be. I just hope that he modifies everything that compared to what, you know, what they were doing a little bit down in Tennessee when, I just think that, you know, in Tennessee, that was, they actually ran the ball more often and ran it less successfully than either season of the exotic smash mouth. And that's what they're trying to like get rid of. We want to bring in this guy from the, you know, the tree of Sean McVay and have this creative offense. And yet it was more run heavy and it was less efficient when they ran the football than it was with the offense they were trying to completely bulldoze off the field. So I don't love that. I hope it was just like even when Mariota was healthy, though, that was still the case, even if you eliminate the games when Mariota wasn't playing. But, yeah, I don't know. I hope that it'll work out with Aaron Rodgers, with the two of them, kind of the chemistry. It's so important to have chemistry between a coach and a quarterback, especially coaches, if he's going to be calling the plays. So I hope it works out for him.
Last question, as always, from Lenny. I take no responsibility for what he asks, and I will honor his request by asking in his voice. Warren! Big fan! Love the mustache! Has anyone ever told you it reminds them of Ben McAdoo? Wow.
I actually haven't gotten the Ben McAdoo. I know Lenny wasn't at Sloan. I don't know if that's what you saw in the mustache from Sloan. I have gotten the comparison to Aaron Rodgers sometimes with his mustache, but definitely never McAdoo. I feel like that makes me want to second think what I'm doing down there, because I don't think McAdoo, at least his hair from the head up, like from the eyebrows up, definitely a point of discussion around the league over the couple of years where he really rocked the down look, not going to comb it, then do the flip back look. So that was a major transition for him.
His mistake was not doing, because it's like when you started a new school, that's when you change your look, so nobody know, or if you want to like have a nickname or something. His problem was doing it like just showing up halfway through, you know, his career there, and people were like, we saw you before. It's obvious you're trying to, you got to do it when you change teams. That's when you got to start slicking your hair back. That was my
thought. I think so. Like, you've got to come in, establish yourself as like the bully or the cool dude or whatever you're going for. You can't flip it. I know AB's trying to flip it with the dyed mustache look.
It's not okay.
That's also interesting. I would not be able to pull that off. I would not be able to pull that off.
That's got
to
be like bringing his trade value down at least like 5 or 6 draft spots.
You know what? I've actually have an idea for Lenny. It would only be $500. I could contribute some of it. You could do AB reading a promo for the pod and shouting out Lenny. It's only $500.
Oh my God. That's amazing. Yeah, for those who don't know, just Google AB Cameo. He's apparently selling off congratulatory messages. The one where he says, congratulations on your second anniversary wedding, and then smiles is maybe my favorite video of 2019. It's spectacular, as were you, Warren. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Huge honor. Ignore Lenny's comments about the mustache. Everyone likes the mustache, I'm pretty sure. He's just being sassy.
I appreciate his honor. Honor's all mine. I definitely love the show, and continue. Best of luck with it. Thanks, Nina.